We're going to pick up now with continuing the mitzvah of the Gerushin, and we had a little bit of a discussion last week about how these themes permeate our Masechta, as you'd be expecting from a Masechta called Gittin, but how there are themes that go beyond the particular mitzvah of Get, and we talked a little bit about some of the broader hashkafic themes of having appreciation for our fragile relationships, not only spousal relationships, but also the relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, and how so many Gemaras that are relevant to that, and most pointedly, the description of the Churban that we're allowed to learn on Tisha B'Av is found in this Masechta also. But another point that we'll also see is that very much the fact of our relationships within society is a major element of Masechus Gittin. So the fact that a get is done publicly, and we saw a little bit about that on Wednesday, how that seems to be built in to the mitzvah. So for example, the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim that we mentioned understood that to be the major reason why we have a mitzvah of get specifically for Gerushin, that it be public and it not be something that can happen secretly and then possibly be true or not true. So the notion of there being a public execution of this divorce is certainly fundamental to what a get is. So the concept of how society addresses its issues and things that happen as a matter of public record is also very much a theme in this Masechta. So that which needs to be archived, that which needs to be taking place in public, but also the theme of the very often possibly misused, possibly appropriated term, it's really a hot-button term nowadays, tikkun olam, which is used in a very flexible way, and a topic really a lot of passion in one direction or the other, so that we mostly know from Aleinu, but as far as Shas is concerned, it's a very prominent presence in Masechus Gittin. So the notion of takanos that were there in order to help society function better or in terms of how to offset certain societal problems is a major theme within Gittin. And we'll see that, God willing, as well in our effort to try to get as broad of a survey of everything in this Masechta. We'll try to see that also. So a big part of that is also the topic of Prosbul, a fascinating, crucial concept to understand, and one that is relevant to us now in this last month of Shemitah. Also happened to be Parsha yesterday, so if you're listening to Kriya Satorah, it set you up for this last month at the convergence of Rosh Chodesh Elul and Parsha Re'eh and the last month of a Shemitah cycle. Last month of a Shemitah year, and we're learning Gittin, so we got quadruple focus on that point leading into these next few weeks. So we certainly want to make sure to take advantage of all of that synergy to appreciate the sugya of Prisbul. So that we're going to be taking a slight detour within the next few weeks to make sure that we get to that before Rosh Hashanah when it's supplied. And that'll also help us to appreciate some of the breadth of this Masechta. But first, to continue with Gittin and its concept. So what we saw on Wednesday was that we have essentially a task to figure out what do we mean by calling Get Gerushin a mitzvah. And it seems like enough of the Rishonim do work off that premise that Gerushin is some kind of a mitzvah. And the Pasuk in Kiseitze could be taken to that effect, and Kiseitze has got skin in the game because it has to hold on to its record as the parsha with the most mitzvos, so Kiseitze certainly votes for counting it as a mitzvah. So we try to figure out what we mean by saying it is a mitzvah, and we gave a couple of possible comparators. What other kinds of mitzvos is it similar to? We know what it's not similar to. We know that it's not like lulav, it's not like matzah. One thing we can say with confidence is that this is not the kind of obligation that we expect everyone to do on any kind of regular basis or even at all in their lifetime, and that should come up for everyone, God forbid. So we know that it's certainly not in that category. However, that still leaves us a lot of room. So could it be a situation where the circumstances which are not common or ideal in any way, but when they present themselves, there's a certain obligation. Is it similar, perhaps, to Yibum or returning Gezela or Sota, all of which are somewhat different from each other, but are closer to that kind of scenario, where there's a circumstance, and the circumstance may call for a certain reaction. And because it's Elul also, we can leave open the question of how does that compare to tshuva? Is tshuva just something that, well, we wish we were all perfect tzaddikim and we didn't have to do tshuva, but if we happen to theoretically be human, so then we have tshuva to do as a reaction to some kind of b'di'eved avera? There's actually quite a discussion about that, as we'll see as we get closer to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. So is tshuva in that kind of category? Or is it not like that either? And maybe it's more like shechita, as some have drawn the comparison, that really it's not anything anyone ever has to do, and it's not even positive in any way, but it's something which, if you want to take a certain path, there's a way you have to do it. And therefore, calling that a mitzvah is all we mean. And shechita is a closer model to that, although shechita a little bit more, because shechita, even though on the one hand it's less than more, because there were Rishonim who argued on the Rambam counting shechita as a mitzvah for that reason, because it's not something that anyone has to do. And of course, it's even a further step removed, because even those of us who may theoretically eat meat, we usually don't shecht it ourselves, so it's kind of itself even a step removed from something any of us have to do in our lifetimes. But is that on the one hand there was a controversy whether to count that as a mitzvah, so it's a little bit less than getting where we see more agreement that it should be counted on some level. But it's more in that there's a bracha on shechita, and there's no bracha on getting, and we have to talk a little bit about why that is. But is that the proper model? So we wanted to suggest on Wednesdays that we saw maybe it's not spelled out, but maybe there's a little bit of a machlokas rishonim on this. So I gave you three models. That on the one hand, the language of the Rambam certainly sounds like it's not a good thing. It's not an imperative in any sense of the word. It's just how you do it if you do it. It's just in that category. And that's probably consistent with the Rambam across the board. The Rambam's language was, I'll call punim kishayirtza lagarish, that in any event, if this is what you want to do, if you choose to divorce, this is how you do it. That's what the mitzvah means. But not that this is something to do. And we noted that this seems to work well with the Tameh HaMitzvot that the Rambam gives in Mar Nebuchim. Because in Mar Nebuchim, there, the Rambam explains what the point of get is. At least one perspective on what the point of get is. So a part of what we're seeing here is that the question of what kind of mitzvah it is translates also to what is the mitzvah. Because is the mitzvah to get divorced, or is the mitzvah to give a get when you get divorced? So according to the Rambam, it's going to come out the mitzvah is to give a get. And that works with his position in Mar Nebuchim, where he says that the reason the Torah has this mitzvah of get is, like we alluded to a few minutes ago, it has to be public, because it goes to the stability of the family. It's the other half of the mitzvah of Kedushin. The mitzvah of Kedushin is necessary that there should be a stable family unit. People shouldn't just decide whenever they're interested in a physical relationship that they can just take it for the moment and then abandon it, and then possibly have children who are not going to have any connection. So there should be a stability to the family unit. And the Rambam says that the other half of that is also that if there's a divorce, if there's an undoing of that, then it's got to be public and clear and undeniable. And for it to be something which just could happen theoretically in secret, and the wife could claim to be divorced and then go off with another guy, and it's not really true. So the Torah is specifically addressing that. So it comes out the mitzvah is not to get divorced, but if there is a divorce, it should happen this way. That's the focus of the Rambam, which is consistent then. The statement of Mishnah Torah is consistent, and in Sefer Mitzvahs rather, is consistent with Mar Nebuchim. Eric?
So when we talk about like the whole conversation of having like these reasons for their mitzvahs, and like for those who consider this mitzvah, how do we frame that within that conversation of trying to be like active you know, like, should, like, is there some sense of, I'll say simcha, but some sense of, like, knowing you're doing a mitzvah when you're doing that, or...
It's a great question, because it's important to help frame why we care about this. And so, and that's a part of what I'm bringing out, so thank you for that, because it's important. Why do we care when we're talking about this as a mitzvah or not as a mitzvah? So I mentioned last week that the whole question of tarayag is itself a little bit of a little bit of a debate. We generally like to hold on to that 613 mitzvah, especially, you know, rise up for 613, so we got to hold on to that mitzvah. Although if there's more, I guess, then that's even better. But rise over 613. But clearly we have a deep attachment to 613 as a number that we're not going to dismiss easily. But the Ramban did acknowledge that there could be some machlokas in that point, but we generally assume 613 mitzvahs. But how do we count? It doesn't really matter that much. I mentioned to you there was a book in the library of the title, Who Cares Whether Batariyag, Why Does It Matter? Something along those lines. So it's an interesting question whether it matters or not. Sometimes I think it matters for lambdas, like it helps us to appreciate why something is counted or isn't counted, or counted with something else or not counted with something else. So sometimes it has conceptual relevance. The fact that the Rambam or the Ramban will argue something is or isn't a mitzvah will tell us something about how they view the relationship of one thing to the other, which could be important. But it also has practical ramifications. So, for example, in this case specifically, the question of, is there ever an imperative to divorce, or is there ever a religious mandate to divorce? That's a part of the question. So whether we mean mitzvah in the sense that this is something you should do, or it's something that just exists as a concept, can actually have practical ramifications. That's one point. So that would be a question about that.
But we know that there's the opposite end, which is the lesasse of, like, if you know you're going to get divorced, you should have relations with your wife.
So that's is that a lo sase, or that's how do you characterize that? That's a good question.
I mean, it's a do not. So,
but it's not a do not in the Torah.
Correct.
You know,
it's in the sense
right.
of.
So what exactly? I mean, that's pashtus. That's about how you relate to the person. Rav Shach likes to explain that as a position of deception, that's basically an abuse of the other person. That if the wife doesn't know that she's about to get divorced, and the husband thinks, okay, I'll just keep her in the dark so I can continue to have relations without her knowing. So that's essentially an Aveira ben Adam Machavero. But if she knows what's happening, then there may not be any yeser at all. So that's itself its own kind of concept. But it's not a lo sase, because it's not a lo sase in the Torah. But whether there is a lo sase here broader, that's part of what we're going to try to figure out today. But so calling this a mitzvah or not is... could have practical ramifications, really. Are we ever saying this is something that should happen, or must, or at least should? Is that ever the thing? And it's opposite, as we'll see. But also, not to get too ahead of ourselves, but for example, a part of where you'll find this discussion is, just to give a very technical example, but it makes a difference. So later on, the Gemara is going to have a discussion around Daf Chav. So let's say, can you write a get on something that is osur b'hana? If you have something that you're not allowed to get hana from, so does writing a get constitute prohibited hana from this item? Now there's a klal of mitzvos lav lehenis nitnu, that performing a mitzvah is not considered usually an example of prohibited hana. So the commentaries work on that sugya as to how do the parts come together. So is writing a get itself an act of hana that would violate nisr hana? Or do we say no, it's a mitzvah. Mitzvahs lav lehenis nitnu. Mitzvahs are exempt from this. So that goes to Eric's question, that there are certain rules that we apply to mitzvahs in general, and does get follow that pattern? So if you have something like mitzvahs lav lehenis nitnu, mitzvahs are excluded from prohibited hanas, not considered to be a prohibited hana. So is get part of that category because it's a mitzvah? Or no, it's not a mitzvah. It's something that's regulated. But
it's very
not.
Interesting that's when you think about
it. Right, that's exactly it.
Even when you compare it to shkita, like, you know, like you're preparing meat to have, and, you know, people like that. Like,
mm-hmm.
versus get is like we're not even, it's something like, you know, we cry about it so hard. Like, you know, we talk about, like, you know.
So it's a sad mitzvah. Chef likes telling the story also that the Sat Merav met Yaakov Kamenetsky, in Muncie, I believe. And he said to me, as you know, so clearly there were differences on the issue of Zionism and the like. And the Sabra Rebbe said to him, I heard that you said that voting in the Israeli election is a mitzvah. Really? You mean it? Mamish, a mitzvah? A mitzvah like matzah? And the Rebbe responded, no, like mar. So a quick question of what mitzvah, you know, different mitzvahs have different characters to them. So how exactly to relate to, so there are a couple of issues, just to break it down. So first of all, as we'll see, and it's a part of why this is an introductory topic, among other reasons, it'll come up throughout the Masechta. So, you know, later on, when you see a sugya like mitzvah, like Gan Ali Sur Hana, and you're wondering, well, what about mitzvah Slav Lehenis Nitnu and all that? So there's a big discussion. A lot of it surrounds that daf. Well, is this a mitzvah in that sense? Or no, we don't, it's a mitzvah. Yeah, it's counted in the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvahs, but it's not a mitzvah in that sense. So that's one category. And subcategory of that, your question about, well, so should I have zrizus and simcha and enthusiasm about the mitzvah? So that theoretically is a part of that larger question. Do we treat? But it's also fair to say that even if we categorize it as a mitzvah in the full sense, there's still going to be human aspects of it, and something that is inherently sad doesn't get treated the same way, which goes to Yaakov's point. Matzah and Mar are both mitzvos in a very similar sense, but one is less unpleasant.
I like the Mar sandwich. I think it balances out well.
Okay, so that will save for Pesach time, but the theoretical relationship. So I think just to go in order, I think we had Caleb and then Zanvi and then Yedidra.
What would the hanah in writing a get be?
The usage of a paper. Let's say you have some kind of a writing surface, which is itself established as an iser hanah, which we'll see again. This, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves because the sugya is for later. But so for now, just talking about very broadly, let's say there's some item which was used for avodah zarah or the like, and so it's asur b'hanah, and you want to write on that. You want to write the get on that. So would that be considered a prohibited use of the item? Or do we say that, no, a get is not a personal hana. It's not like using it for your diary. You're using it for a mitzvah. And there is an extensive discussion in the commentaries on that daf. Is that the right language here? Do we say it's a mitzvah in that sense? No, it's a mitzvah in the Rambam, but it doesn't mean that it's a mitzvah like something you're obligated to do, which goes also to the lumdus of what mitzvahs lav v'hanis nitnu, which is, again, we don't get too ahead of ourselves. Zanvi?
What about the opposite of withholding the get? Is that an aveiro?
That's a huge issue. Hopefully we'll get to that as well. It's not totally covered here, although we'll get a little bit of the roots of it. And certainly we want to talk about that as the year goes on, but it's not yet there. I mean, it happens to be related to this point, but we're only going to get the very, very tips of it now. Did you?
How would it not be categorized as a mitzvah? If it's literally mitzvah, like it's literally commanded in the Torah, it's literally a mitzvah.
So the question, what does it mean, commanded? Is anyone ever, that's part of the question that we're trying to discuss today, is it ever the case that anyone is commanded to divorce?
I mean, it seems like there's definitely some mitzvah regarding get, it seems like the Rambam is onto something about it, dafka being a get. Like dafka being a get, if it comes to that, but like there's no one could deny that there's not a mitzvah regarding get.
Except that let's say if one chooses never to get divorced, so then is it in that category? Now again, clearly it's counted, and it's counted by a lot of the Moniham mitzvos. So there's some definition of mitzvah that applies to it, but seeing that there are different ways to interpret the word mitzvah, it's something that leaves open still a lot of room. So what we started to see is that the Rambam, it sounds like he does not see it as a mitzvah in that sense. He doesn't see it as a mitzvah to divorce, ever. He sees it only as, if one chooses to divorce, here's how it has to be done. But if one never decides to divorce, Baruch Hashem, or hopefully everything's good in Baruch Hashem. You know, if things are, as Zanvi alluded to, it might actually be bad. But theoretically, you know, then that's the best case scenario. If everybody's happy and whatever decides to get divorced, the best case scenario. So that was within the Rambam. What we saw is that the Sefer HaChinuch maybe diverges from that, even though it's a little bit tricky, because Sefer HaChinuch uses the same opening language as the Rambam, giving you the impression that he's in accord. But on a Tameh HaMitzvahs level, the Sefer HaChinuch is more about the divorce itself. because he talks about the fact that when there are religions that don't have divorce, so today we're familiar with, I think, the position of the Catholic Church, historically, I'm sure there are other religions also, where if there's no possibility of divorce, so that the Sefer HaChinuch presents as bad for the marriage, because it means no one has an incentive to try to act properly within the marriage. They know that it's a deal for life that they're never going to get out of or never going to be sent out of. So that's not good for the marriage. That's where the Sefer HaChinuch presents it. So what emerges from his Tamei HaMitzvos, at least, even though it's not perfect with his opening language, is that it sounds like the mitzvah is, theoretically, to divorce or to keep that option open so that it doesn't allow the marriage to be taken for granted. Which, like we also alluded to, we said that the theme of having gittin before kedushin should help us appreciate the marriage. What we're seeing here is that that's probably also a theme in the Tamei HaMitzvos. It's not just a drush. It's not just something that's a nice speech to give, but it seems like also really to be built in. So that Sefer HaChinuch is really saying that, right? Saying that if there's no possibility of divorce, then the marriage is not going to be valued in and of itself. It's not going to be treated with the sense of responsibility that it should have. So in the perfect world, for the Sefer HaChinuch, no one will get divorced, but everyone's marriage will be perfect because the possibility keeps them on their toes. And that's presumably the ideal situation the Chinuch would describe. And we mentioned the Abravanel, which is a little bit of a, not to seem pedantic, by the way, no question of Barbanel and Abravanel, so I think nowadays there's more support for the Abravanel position. But the, so assuming that that's the proper pronunciation, so the Abravanel, which you can look up, by the way, I didn't put on the list, but you know, it's in the Sefer on Kiseitse. So there, he seems to kind of combine both, that his Tamei HaMitzvos gives you a reason for a mitzvah of divorce, and a mitzvah to divorce specifically with a get. That mitzvah of divorce, because a little bit of a twist on the Sefer HaChinuch's perspective, but that if we want marriage to represent the perfect potential for the two spouses to be able to live up to who they could be, if they're with a person who is not going to allow that to happen, so then it means that now the marriage is not what it could be, and so let's allow the marriage to be perfect with someone else. So divorce has to be there for that reason. And then again, theoretically, that leaves room to say that maybe on some level that couple has a mitzvah to divorce. But also, he goes on to say, why with a get? So to go back to the Rambam model, why specifically in this way? Because we got to make it difficult. We got to make it at least something that has a process to it, because we want it to be possible, but not something that people take too lightly, and that just because they have one fight, they're going to decide, okay, that's it, it's over. If it's too easy, that could be very bad on a lot of levels. So we need to find the sweet spot, essentially, or the bitter spot, I guess would be the better way to put it, of the bittersweet spot of it being possible but being difficult. And that's essentially how it comes out. So that's an interesting perspective also. And again, all three of these views really are consistent with the idea that the concept of get, and putting gittin before kedushin, again, beyond the joke, really is meaningful. That really a common element to all these explanations is that the existence of gittin as a possibility, all in a perfect world, will make kedushin stronger, will make kedushin a more solid and valued endeavor. So that's all something to think about as far as that's concerned. So the idea, by the way, that the Bravnal mentioned about it being harder, this is a theme specifically for Lermesachus Ksubas, so it comes up a lot there, that one of the reasons the Ksuba exists, we generally assume the Ksuba is a Takana de Rabbanan, though there is a view in the Rishonim, a view in the Gemara, that Ksuba deraisa, it may be some kind of mixture of both, but we generally relate to Ksubas de Rabbanan. But to the extent that that's the case, so the Gemara is explicit, at least to a certain extent, that it's so that divorce shouldn't be too casual. So if the husband has to take on a big financial obligation together with divorce, so then he'll think twice. And the Gemara also talks about, over there in Ksubas, about different stages in history as to how easy that payment was to make. So on the one hand, so the Gemara says that they wanted to make sure that the value of the ksuba was tied to some object, otherwise maybe he didn't have it and then it wouldn't be much of a motivation. Same way the law requires you to have insurance when you drive, because if you can't prove that you can pay for damages, so then you're invulnerable. So we have to make sure that it's possible to pay for the ksuba. But then the Gemara says there was also a problem with that, because if they said, okay, so you have a valuable vase in the house, that vase vase, another pronunciation question, you have a valuable piece of pottery in the house that is worth the value of the ksuba, that also could be a problem, because then maybe he'll just get angry at her one day and take the pottery and say, here, take this and leave. And it should be too easy for him to pay off the ksuba. So there's a constant push-pull here of, yes, there has to be this possibility of divorce, and sometimes you have to actually pull the trigger, but ideally it'll just be there as a threat, so to speak, and as a corrective. So we want it to be possible, and yet not too easy, because too easy is as destabilizing as impossible. So we can't live with it being impossible, we can't live with it being too easy, we need to have something in the middle. Okay, so far so good. So now, I'll go into a little bit more probably tomorrow about the formulation in the Achronim about this question, some of which does surround the Get Bisuri Hanah Sugya as a platform for some of that discussion. But for the most part, in the Achronim, the way they formulate it is similar to the way we've seen in the Rambam, that it's not really a mitzvah in the imperative sense, but it is a protocol within the Torah for how this should be carried out, when it has to happen, and a different kind of mitzvah than we usually see. But the question still, even if you want to call it something less than a mitzvah, do we have any opinion about when it should or shouldn't happen? So there's still much more to discuss. And as you've had a chance to see by now, so the most explicit source about this is the often quoted Mishnah on Daf Tzadi, the last Mishnah, the very end. There's a lot to say about how Gittin is structured, for the fact that this is really the end, the closing note of Maseches Gittin. But the Mishnah that you saw on Daf Tzadi, Beis Shammai Omrim Lo Yigarish Adam Es Ishto Elim Kein Matza Ba Dvar Erva Shenamar Ki Matza Ba Erva Stavar Ubeis Hil Omrim Afilu Hichdicha Tavshilo Shenamar Ki Matza Ba Erva Stavar. So there's a lot that jumps out at you about this Mishnah. So first of all, let's get a sense. So what questions do you have reading this Mishnah? You probably saw the Gemara also afterwards, which has some important possible qualifications. But what strikes you as needing definition? What questions do you have reading this Mishnah? Go.
First thing is, what is Erev
Stavar? Okay. Right. So clearly that's a topic of drasha here, Erev Stavar. It's also noteworthy that even according to Beis Shammai's opinion, that we're very limited here and it has to be Erev Stavar. So does that mean literally Gilui Arayos? So that's a good question.
In the Torah we mentioned Erev Stavar and Pritzos.
Correct.
But the distinction is other separate things. So yes. Exactly isn't the gather of either.
It's a great question. So let me ask you just while you're at that question on the table. So what do you think? Does Erev Stavar equal Gilui Arayos, or is it something less? Is it something... What would you say about that, Eric?
The Torah seems to imply that Erev Stavar includes anything. Pritzos being kind of the minimum, because he says Erev
Stavar... Okay, so not necessarily the full definition of Gilui Arayos.
Anything that would constitute, I guess, doing things that are kind of between a man and a woman.
Okay, so something in the parsha, what you might call, halachically, you might call this abizrayu, the Gilui Arayos, that which is in the area, in the neighborhood of Gilui Arayos, but not necessarily actual Gilui Arayos. Okay, yeah?
So it would be something that you could, that in another context, he would accuse his wife of being a sota for.
Or get to the process of suspected suffix sota. Right, so the question is, because sota literally does mean that she actually was involved in Gilui Arayos, but bring to the trial of sota. So the kind of things, the first Mishnah in sota talks about what we call kinoi and stira, and that involves that there's a certain level of suspicion because of her overall behavior. So just like Donald's suggesting, just like we find that in the concept of sota, so there is the actual Arayos, but it is prompted as a suspicion by certain kind of behaviors. So maybe what we're talking about here is an extension of the concept of Gilui Arayus, that which makes her suspect of Gilui Arayus. Is there a significance to the phrase Erva's Davar as opposed to Erva? Yeah?
My question on that is, why would we read it as two separate things? Why not just read it as Erva's Davar?
Okay, so on the one hand, so the Gemara seems to be darshaning this language and assuming there's different things. But what about the fact that the Mishnah phrases it this way? Just to work off that line.
I think that's the substance of machlokas between Bishal Mishnah.
It might be.
Erva's Davar or Erva's Davar.
To a certain extent it is, right? But even just in the view of Beis Hillel, right? So let's say, what we had was Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai, it's just in the view of Beis Shammai, right? So Beis Shammai, Omer, Legarish, Adonis, Ishto, Elam, Ke Matzaba, Dvar, Erva. So Dvar, Erva, does he mean Gilui Arayus, or does he mean something in the whole parsha? Is there a difference between Dvar, Erva, and Erva, and Arayus?
Presumably, if he didn't use the word Erva, the Torah didn't use really, like, he had the Torah, the word Dvar is used, so it's obviously not just directly Erva, but it's something Dvar in the category of. Or else it would have said Erva.
So it's an interesting question, is that so? Maybe it is. But there's some who say that there's basically three ways you could read this, or two or three ways you could read this. You could read this as intentionally not saying Erva, and saying something broader, and maybe because that's what the Torah means also. And if you look at some of the Mefarshim on Chumash, such as the Netziv and the Meshech Chachma, so they both make comments here that Erva's Davar, in their interpretation, does not mean Gilui Arayus literally, and that it's meant to be a broader phrase than that. And it means something in the world of that, something with some connection to that, but not necessarily literally that. So as far as what the Torah means, so that's a point that these Mefarshim raise. And as far as what Beis Shammai means in the Mishnah, so one could say that he's also talking in that language. Or one could say, no, he means Gilui Arayus, but he's using language inspired by the pasuk of Davar being a part of the phrase. And one could also make note of the fact that it may just be a Gersa issue, because if you look at the Mishnah as it is brought in the Yerushalmi, so the language of the Mishnah in the Yerushalmi is Erva, without fire. So then maybe that's a difference as far as how to relate to it. Eric?
I have another thing that's interesting in Mishnah. It says, so you don't divorce your wife, only divorce your wife in cases. Is this talking about Sarah? Is this talking about Yachol? Is it talking about just
terrific question. So that's a huge issue. That's something we need to clarify also. That's very much not explicit here, and we need to figure it out. And that's something we're going to try to get to also in the next few minutes. So, first of all, but that's an important question, right? So I was asking for questions, so that's certainly very much, maybe that should credit you more, but that might be the most important question.
It's also really interesting,
right?
When you get to the Torah, and the Torah just separates, or maybe it's going around, the separation between basically first wife, second wife, and the first wife, you're allowed, it's only really with Erva's Davar, and the second wife, it's really with, you can use Erva's Davar, and can also use things that you just don't profit in Matzachim. Which I think is really interesting, because let's say you go the way of mitzvah. If you go the way of mitzvah, that means you might be saying you have to divorce your second wife if there's something you just don't like, that she burns the food or something. But if you go by terms of yachol, that means you can only divorce your first wife if she does something that's erva's davar, right? Something, preaches, whatever. So you can hate each other, but as long as she's not doing erva's davar, you still can get divorced. So either way, you seem with something that's a very, very extreme in terms of
yeah. Now, so the question of the distinction between the first wife and the second wife, which distinction comes out from the Gemara, and what that distinction is based on is an interesting question. It's also not clear, as some point out, that whether, even though we seem to split as far as la halacha between the first and the second, the way it's brought in Shulchan Aruch and the like, is that actually a difference that Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel would acknowledge, or is that just we're splitting the difference between them? So we paskin like one in one case and one like the other case. But do they themselves acknowledge that there's a valid distinction between the two in their own positions? Or do we do we basically split them up based on some other factors? That's something also needs to be determined. But I should mention that the question you raised before that is probably the most important question of this Mishnah. Right? So we have three categories, but probably the most important question is, what is Mishnah talking about? Is this talking about when you're allowed to divorce? Is it talking about when it's a good idea to divorce? Is it talking about, is there some kind of mitzvah, which all plugs back into our previous question of, is there ever an imperative? And if there's an imperative, so is that what this Mishnah is answering? Here's when there's an imperative? Or is it saying, no, there's never an imperative, but here's when it's permitted? Or is it somewhere in between? Sometimes there's an imperative, sometimes it's permitted, and sometimes it's not. Title?
Another question on the Mishnah, Rabbi Akiva's shita of, if he found someone that he likes better than his wife, he can just divorce her for that.
So what do you want to do with that, right? So
where does that come from? How is that?
It's disturbing. Right, so what to do with that also? So first of all, just to note that every stage in the Mishnah is subject to clarification. So we said, Ervas Davar, Arayas Mamish alike. So that we already acknowledged is subject to clarification. What about Hikdicha Tevshila? So that also seems kind of petty. And it seems kind of minor. Would you really divorce over that? So it's important to note, at least just to clarify it, that many of the Mefarshim have the language that, and you can see this, you know, the Torah Tmima has a discussion about this, which we'll say more about in a second. But also, if you look at the way Rosh Hashanah Fel Hirsch, others, the way they read this Mishnah in the context of the Pasuk, that Hekticha Tevshilo means intentional. So it doesn't just mean that she just made a mistake and she was distracted taking care of the kids and a bunch of other things and she forgot that something was on the oven. Right? That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about there's a level of spite in the relationship. And somehow, every other dish is coming out perfect, but the dish for her husband specifically has some kind of problem with it because, you know, she's davka sabotaging it on purpose with a note. So, you know, if there's a level of animosity there, that's what we're talking about. So, I think if you process this line, not just as she was distracted, but there's real spite between them, so then it becomes easier to relate to as a significant factor. And that's very possibly what's going on. Some also point out, and again, a reference to Torah Tmim, who has a long discussion about this, that it could also be a mashal for other things. And we do find elsewhere in the Torah, that this language is sometimes a mashal for other kinds of bad behavior. And doesn't necessarily refer to cooking. So it could mean that just in other ways she's acting in a disreputable fashion or in a negative fashion, but still less so than Ervas Davar. But she's bringing disrepute upon the relationship in the household. I think it's Dov Yedidja and then back to Eric.
That makes an even bigger gap between, you know, bringing food than found someone prettier.
Yes. Okay.
Assuming it was just an accidental thing, then there's at least somewhat of a linear level of just making it
right. Right, we're getting a little bit right.
But like, if it's, you know, both of them are just both, there's trouble in the relationship, then he just found someone prettier, just huge gap in terms of.
Okay, so there's still more to expand about that, and I'll come back to that in a second, because as we're going through each level, so you're right, and we'll see this, maybe what to say even about that third level also. So I think you did it with
that. Right, no, just on the Tanal's point about that, the last point about, like, you go to the Chalkas Mechokek, where he said about it could be like actually burning by mistake, but if it troubles you that much, you know, that ideally you should turn the other cheek. And be over Amitosa, like he says.
People that really love each other are not going to get
right. Tired. Well, you won't get tired, but there's obviously something that gets deeper if you just. You by mistake burn your dish and then you get, you know, super frustrated. There's obviously something deeper in that relationship that's not going to work. So it's like, ideally, it shouldn't be from just burning the dish, but, you know, but if you can't be over amidosa, then there's something larger at play.
Which is also a good Rosh Hashanah phrase, my amidosa.
Right.
Also more synergy. Eric? And then
I just have another thing while I was thinking.
All right,
so what Rabbi Akiva says, I think it's two things I guess I add to the conversation. One, he seems to be the only one placing something on what the husband does, as granted words, as opposed to Beisha Reishel, who places it solely on the wife. And secondly, I was just thinking about this. I mean, Dara'isa, polygamy is allowed. So why would it be grounds for divorce to like look at another woman and say, I want to marry her too?
Okay, that's a great question. So that's also so much question. We're going to spill over into tomorrow, but there's a lot of stuff to clarify. Zavi?
Just on Yadidya's point, how could it get to that point in the first place? Meaning, assuming they've been together at least a day, they've spent time, and obviously we're saying that it's mashal or whatever we want to say it's for, there's obviously some deeper issues to it. So how could it get to this point and be okay with that?
What do you mean by okay? So
to the point of marriage, I guess.
Unfortunately, relationships change radically. And part of it is because also intense emotions flip the easiest. And, you know, so they say the opposite of love isn't hate, it's apathy. So, you know, that the more intense you feel about someone, the easier it is to flip, unfortunately, to the opposite direction, especially for certain kinds of personalities. So it is, unfortunately, more common than you might think, that someone may feel like they want to marry someone and the next day feel, well, hopefully not the next day, but you know, so in relatively short order, for things to... Now, it's not going to be about the meal, it's going to be about something else, but it manifests itself that.
Correct, but the point here is what we're saying is that, like, even the smallest thing gets said about why is that okay that, like, we're letting the smallest thing change?
Well, because the point is it's not about that. It's that, you know, that this is going to be reflective of some deep dysfunction in the relationship. So can it be fixed? Maybe. But if it can't, you know, she's continuously, if you interpret it this way, that she's continuously looking to spite him, then there's something more than that. So then the next step also, so idea of that matzah cheres noa himena, so as Dov was saying, right, that really seems to be the hardest to relate to. And so there also to emphasize, and this is really a much longer discussion from a lot of levels, but... And we're really going to have to spill over tomorrow, probably diving up here again. But we'll have at least one mincha and el downstairs. But just to make sure we have enough of...
Still Rosh Chodesh.
Still Rosh Chodesh, right. Yeah, but yesterday was like Rosh Chodesh, but not el. Today is el. But anyway, so the point is that... So first of all, it's not that there's some kind of objective criteria here that he's supposed to be married to the most beautiful woman, and he found out there's actually one fairest of them all by asking the mirror, by holding a beauty contest like the Achashverosh. But you know, the emphasis here is on Matzah, you know, that he finds it to be. And this is something which I'm going to really, if I let myself get started on this, I'm really going to say more than we have time for. Maybe it's a topic to talk about later, because I think it's very relevant to the whole Shiduchim discussion and has actually halachic ramifications on a lot of levels. But just to say a very, very short version of it for now, it's that the attraction that a couple feels for each other is to a great degree subjective and has to do with the way they perceive each other, and that's part of the dynamic behind Kalanav Chasuda. It's really a lot to say about this. Maybe it becomes more, today is Sunday, but a little bit more of a Sunday topic, but also especially as you guys get closer or into the Shiduchim Parsha more, it's something really should be discussed in greater detail. But to appreciate just how much the attraction element, especially after they're already married, how much it is connected to emotional investment and not to anything outside that. So the idea that he doesn't find her to be the most beautiful woman in the world is more about how he relates to her subjectively than about some kind of beauty contest standard. Now, that being the case, even within that definition, we're still halacha rejecting this as a criterion. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says not to do. And so it's still ultimately not going to make it to advice. But even to the extent that Rabbi Akiva, and remember Rabbi Akiva, the Baal HaVi Ahavta L'Arecha Kamocha, right? So Rabbi Akiva, you wouldn't expect to be coming from this perspective. And as you recall, spoke about last week, that same mitzvah, V'Ahavta L'Arecha Kamocha, Rabbi Akiva is that Klal Gadol B'Torah, V'Ahavta L'Arecha Kamocha is the mitzvah that tells you you have to love your wife. So make of that what you will. There may be quite a lot to figure out about that. But it's not coming from a beauty contest ranking standard and saying, okay, I thought that she was number one in the country, now I see she's number three, so I have to trade her for number one. Presumably, even in this position that is being rejected, it doesn't mean that. It means that he's not able to find her as meaningful to him as he once was, and that that's also something that reflects the problem. Right.
But then why is it phrased in that he found someone else who's better than her, as
yeah,
opposed to
he should...
finding it phrased as he found something wrong with her?
I think it's the same point, that like, you know, see, ideally he shouldn't have eyes for anyone else. No one else should be, you know, his focus on her should be so absolute that nobody else is meaningful. The fact that somebody else is able to draw his attention means that he's not feeling the way he should be. Again, this is according to the rejected opinion, the opinion the socialist said not to do. But it's saying that even within that, it's not about some ideal that he should be married to number one on the list, however you quantify that, but it's about how he perceives her. So in all of these three statements, there's some level of ambiguity, and Erev HaSdavar has its own ambiguity for, and there it gets into real halachic issues because of the potential of a real sota issue. But the other two, which don't touch upon these more significant objective halachic issues, but also presumably represent more than the words overtly say, and either that, in the second opinion, there's really active spite between them, or in the third position, not necessarily active spite, but there's a lack of real commitment and interest to each other. So even on top of all that, so again, much more time, the Torah Tamimah. Torah Tamimah has a discussion about this where he says, still, all of this, it's not b'chavadik for Benos Yisrael to be rated on this standard, and it's hard to imagine that this is really our value system, and that, that's what we would consider as grounds for divorce. So he suggests, in the end of this whole back and forth, is that these last two conditions are really there, davka, to provide more of a cover. Because he says, let's say, for example, there was some concern in the first category of some kind of Erev HaSdavar issue, but somewhere maybe on some level ambiguous, and they get divorced for that reason. So imagine what it would be like if it was known that the only time there's ever a heter for divorce is suspicion of erva. And so what kind of a design would that be? Right, so imagine if that was the premise, that every divorce only happened because of that. And then if a couple got divorced, so what kind of a humiliation would that be, especially if there was some kind of mistake or was a suspicion? So the Torah Tamimah suggests that having these as possibilities, even if they don't reflect necessarily the highest ideal of spiritual connection, but having these as possibilities tells us that, okay, there could be more, so you know, it's none of your business, you don't have to talk about it, so if a divorce happens, you don't have to speculate, okay, I know it's only Erev HaSdavar because that's the only thing that's mutter, but you know, I don't know, so maybe it's anything in this wide range of possibilities, and it's not my business. So that's ultimately what the Torah Tamimah does with this. He says that even according to the most mundane and unimpressive interpretations of what these standards are, maybe they're not really there to be implemented, but they're there to provide cover so that if a divorce happens, you give them their space and understand it could be anything within a range of different possibilities, and you don't have to assume it was dafka the worst of the possibilities.
So basically, if three-way machlok is basically just to cover up for basically lashon hara, I guess. So,
essentially, so. Yeah. According to that perspective, but I mean, but it comes out to a metzias still anyway. You know, that allowing it doesn't just mean that. I don't think he means just have a cover story. So it means that practically speaking, yes, it still means that marriages could fall apart for lesser reasons. But that also has an overall effect of not boxing any one relationship into this narrow category, which also is a bizarre to the couple, should it become perceived that way. Shmuel.
Would it mean, though, that the Torah to know whether it could, like, marriages should only fall apart because of, like,
well, I think,
reasons?
Yeah, so we're having to get into this more tomorrow, but I think everyone would really agree with that, right? Because, go back to Eric's primary question, which is the primary question here, really, right? You win the prize. So what is the main message of this Mishnah? Are we talking about should, can, must, etc.? And then by default, what's the rest about? But I think everyone would basically agree that category B and category C is not ideal. right? You Rebbe Akiva and Beis Hillel, especially the friendly ones, right? So you know, you would think that if anyone's going to try to keep together a marriage that can be saved, it would be Rebbe Akiva and Beis Hillel, right? Rebbe Akiva is like Haftarecha Kamocha, like Klal Rabbi Torah, and Beis Hillel is Kal Nav Chesuda all the time, right? These are the opinions we're talking about, right? If you try to graft these on to their views elsewhere, it's particularly interesting. And so it's particularly striking that it's the Beis Hillel of Kalanah v'Chasud across the board and the Rabbi Akiva of Yehavdarecha Kamocha across the board. So the fact that they're the ones saying this, so I think it's safe to assume that absent Gilui Arayos or something in the first category, or actual bad behavior that really undermines the family's spirituality, categories B and category C, even if you allow them, we are probably not recommending this if there's any way to fix it. And that's, so I think that's probably safe to say that that is a common element here, that ideally, even to whatever extent we grant B and C, we are still hoping that it's a fixable situation and encouraging that. Dope?
Even though the Torah brings down Beis Hillel and Halacha?
Yeah, because again, the question is, what are we talking about? Are we talking about it? Yeah, so that, you know, if you can fix it, you know, then for sure we're going to say that that's... But plug this back into now the whole question of what divorce is for. So if you say, like the Sefer HaChinuch or the Abravanel, that it's there either to keep the couple motivated, that they should bring everything, bring their A-game to the marriage and make sure that it is everything it could be, or the Abravanel, that if there's a marriage that just is not able to be what it could be, so then it should make space for something else. So then we could also understand how position B and position C fit into that spectrum. That if there is just a lack of perfect compatibility because of spite, yichatav shilo, or because of a lack of proper focus on the other, matza acheres noyimana, so that is something which could resonate on that level, that it's not the marriage it could be, or they're not committed enough to the marriage, perhaps, as the Sefer HaChinuch was indicating, and then either fix it or not. You know, either it could be fixed, or it shouldn't endure, and that's the framework in which that seems to exist. Hi.
As we dive like deeper into like what we're talking about and what's advisable, what's not advisable, and how, like, because I guess we keep opening up on about like the feelings of those involved and like how it affects the marriage. Is there something to say about matzah everstover as opposed to like yeshba everstover? And it's like a
very possibly, like, yeah. Like I said, that first phrase leaves a lot of ambiguity still. So you know whether it's that. Even though, so just to clarify, so now we're going to just give a little bit of roadmap for tomorrow because we're going to have mechon then. But so let's see what's still unresolved here, right? So we still haven't answered your question about are we talking about mitzvah or hetter, right? So that's something to start with tomorrow. And then what's going to be very important to discuss is, so what are we saying about the rest? So, for example, if we take this as mitzvah, what kind of mitzvah? Like we saw, there was some kind of question about that. So if we read this Mishnah saying, here's where you're supposed to, what do we mean supposed to? Literally must or advisable or the like. But if we take it as a heter, that these are the situations that one's allowed to, so what does it say about the others? It's iser? Iser mamish? Bad advice? Or, you know, good advice not to? So that's going to be a major question. Is there some kind of avera involved in divorcing when one does not meet this criteria? Or is it more than a aver? Is it not even an effective gershon? Would that mean, I think you always asked me that in the marriage, right? Or somebody asked me that in the marriage, right? Or, you know, is that, and that's something
we'll have
to do with that, right? So you can be made, we have an aid, right? So is that, will we even say the divorce wouldn't, on at some level, be chal if it doesn't meet this criteria, which, hard to believe it, is it possible there's such a view? So we need to figure out what the Mishnah is saying and what it's saying by implication. Right, what are the consequences for anything that doesn't meet this threshold? So all of that we're going to have to still determine tomorrow. It's also going to get into the whole concept of Cherim Derbeinu Gershom, how that interacts with this. So we got a lot of work cut out for us. Did you? Did you
I was just thinking it's similar because it's like funny that Bezalel and Kiva are the ones that say, you know, you could easily get divorced. So I think it's like they're also something about like breaking a fast that we're not, you know, makel on fasting, you know, we're machmer and like, you know, shvartin and mo'ed v'chaseichem. So
right.
It's like we're not makel on divorce per se, but we're machmer av after the rechak mocha. That's why if you don't respect your wife or whatever, it's not a good relationship.
You're not fulfilling.
And then they're making it easier to get divorced, right? To be able to be kind of someone else and be able to separate that, you know, toxic relationship or whatever. So they're being more machmir about av after rechak mocha than meishamim, makes it harder to get divorced.
So it's a very striking point, right? Because each one, on the one hand, there's a question that's prompted by the views that we know they held elsewhere. But I think you're also right that that helps us to understand both opinions stronger. So, like, if you take Rabbi Akiva's view, who holds V'haftar Echkamocha is everything, Zechal Gadol B'Torah, so, and put that together with the Gemara Kedushin that says the spousal relationship is specifically viewed through V'haftar Echkamocha. So then maybe your point is that's gufa it, that if it's not perfect, the Ahava, then you're not fulfilling this mitzvah and move on to somebody else. But it's also do with it, maybe think about this for tomorrow, Beis Hillel's opinion is even more striking, right? Because Beis Hillel's opinion in the Gemara in Ksubos, which was Daf Yomi, now it's already a month, Daf Yomi ago, but the idea that Beis Shammai says against Beis Hillel there, but Beis Hillel's the view that every Kala, Kala Nova Chasuda, and then within that attitude still, but Kicha Tevshilo, forget it. So how to either reconcile those opinions or say along the path you're saying that one really strengthens the other. It shows that if you can't, even with your commitment to pre-commitment of Kalanov Chazuda, it's still like Dicha Tavshilo is something very striking to think about. So with that, we will down Mincha. Do we have a volunteer?
I don't know.